I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, everybody. We've got something super exciting for you. Everybody loves a survey.
Survey time.
Oh, my God. I love surveys. And you know what? It would actually mean a boatload to us if you could help us with the survey that we want you to do.
We have some super important questions that we want to ask you. We're trying to figure some things out so that we can go on and develop this new crazy idea to change the world.
Yeah, so we're not going to tell you too much about it because it's very top secret, keeping it very close to the chest right now, but it means a lot to us and it could change the world. And so you could be a part of that by going to sickboypodcast.com/support and taking the super fun survey.
And it's like a super fun survey that only takes like 5 minutes.
If that. I think it takes less. I did it and it's very quick.
You know what? You saying that you did it makes me want to do it. So I'm going to go do it right now.
Oh my God. Thanks, Brian. That's super helpful of you.
And everybody listening should also pause the podcast right now. We're going to be back with some more important messages after this, but pause the podcast and go to sickboypodcast.com/support and do the super fun survey.
Super fun survey. Honestly, you'll like it. It'll make you think.
sickboypodcast.com/support.
sickboypodcast.com/support.
support/support.
sickboypodcast.com/support. Hey everybody, Taylor here.
And Brian.
We have some live show dates that we want to tell you about. And if you want to get tickets for any of our live shows, you can go to sickboypodcast.com/shows. So first up, we're going to be in Vancouver on October 29th and 30th at CBC Vancouver. The show on the 29th is already sold out. It sold out in less than a day. So we added a second show, and that has very limited seats left. So get your tickets ASAP for that. We're going to love to see all y'all out in Vancouver. We're also going to be in Calgary on November 1st at the Southern Alberta Institute of Technology at SAIT. Tickets are on sale now for that as well.
We will be in November. We will be in November by the time we get to Toronto, which is the fourth day of the month. We'll be at Entertainment One headquarters. We're doing a live show there. Tickets just went on sale. So if you're hearing this on Monday when this episode is released, definitely go get them right now. They're going to go very quickly. The following day on November 5th, we are going to be at the Ted Rogers Cinema for CBC's Podcast Playlist Live, part of the Hot Docs Podcast Festival. So if you don't get to see us the day before, definitely come to that. Sorry, Victoria. We were trying to include you guys on this trip, but we had a little bit of logistical hiccup, if you will, and weren't able to get a venue locked down. So we're confident that next time we will have a venue. So we will see you the next time we come out west. And Halifax, we love you. Stay tuned. We're going to be announcing an upcoming show date before the end of the year. So stay tuned, Halifax. We love you very much.
And later on in December, we are hoping to do two shows in the U.S. And they will be our first live shows in the U.S. We're looking to do one in San Francisco and L.A. So if you are a listener in San Fran or L.A. and you know a good live show venue that we should know about, you can write into our Instagram. You can email us info@sickboypodcast.com, message us on Facebook, whatever way you want to get in touch with us. Give us your suggestions so we can get in touch with some bars down there and figure it out and bring the live show experience to the West Coast of the U.S. We want to see you there.
Yo, Tay, speaking of U.S. listeners, mm-hmm. we've heard loud and clear from the people of Washington, D.C. that they want us to come there and do a show.
Yeah, they're hardcore.
So I think we're going to have to include them in a live show tour date schedule for early 2019.
Yeah, well, if you're a D.C. listener, why don't you go go over to our Instagram and leave some comments. We did a live show post the other day, and you can go on there and tell us what you think. And again, if you have any venue suggestions for Washington, D.C., let us know. We'd love to know where we can have a show. So again, go to sickboypodcast.com/shows for all of our tickets for our shows. Love y'all.
See you soon.
Tough. It's a tough little journey.
Well, I'm a Kundalini freak.
Yeah.
But that's a different thing altogether. That's not exercise at all. It's not about, for me, it's not about asana. It's about like joyful heart, joyful breath, pranayama, all this stuff.
Yeah.
And I didn't return to yoga until I was in cancer care. And there was one instructor at the hospital who was giving basically free movement classes. But what it really was yoga.
Mm-hmm.
Right. As soon as she said yoga, patients became intimidated.
Yeah, absolutely.
So her having a movement class that encouraged people to get mobility back into their, whether it was their arms from radiation or whatever it was. And it made me connect with her reasoning, which was just basically, you know, Raga yoga.
Yeah.
You know,
that's really interesting because for me, you talked about like the power of having a group of people together practicing. But for me, the actual asana, I feel like I can get the most benefit from a really individual practice, like doing it on my own.
Yes.
But, when it comes to like meditation or yoga nidra,
yes,
like being in a room with other people, there's something, even though it's like even more personalize the experience.
Right.
Just having that energy around feels really powerful.
Mm.
Like I've had some of the craziest experiences in a group of people, but like totally on my own, but with other people around.
So you're probably, if you were into Ashtanga, then you'd be familiar with Patabi Joyce.
Yes.
And so Krishnamacharya was, you know, Patabi Joyce's teacher.
Right.
And Krishnamacharya had a handful of sort of, you know, disciples, if you will. And one of them is a guy named Srivatsa Ramaswamy.
Mm.
And he's the last of this group of students of his that is alive. And he's a teacher of mine. So he's been like the biggest influence on my style of teaching and my sort of my philosophy of teaching over the last, I guess it's been like 3 or 4 years now. And so there's lots of, actually at the studio that I own a yoga studio, and I don't know if I mentioned that or if I said I just teach, but at the studio, it's like kind of everything under the sun. Every teacher has their own sort of background.
Right.
So there's like a little bit of everything. And then everybody who comes kind of
figures out which path they
sort of fall into the groove, the teacher that they sort of resonate with. And in that way, you see like a lot of people going to the same teacher's class. So you're kind of getting this more, like you're getting a bit of a continuous study from the similar person. So like the source is similar, which I find really helpful. And it can be so hard to find a yoga that works.
But what it's done is it's forced me to go inward.
Mm.
And so it actually taught me a big lesson this year, which is if I want to deepen my practice or just basically further my growth, I was forced to really examine and self-reflect and just do it myself.
Yeah.
I went to a couple of classes that were Kundalini based, and they're very whimsical.
I know.
A little whimsical for me sometimes.
But
joyful.
Yeah.
And it enabled me to just kind of become a 10-year-old.
There's something also about Kundalini that, that's it. The 10-year-old thing.
Yeah.
Because if you went in there, like anybody who, especially somebody who's going, I've never really done that much yoga, doesn't really know what we mean by what Kundalini yoga is.
Right.
If you went to a Kundalini class, you'd spend the first 5 minutes being like, where the fuck am I?
And what the fuck is going on?
Yeah, what is going on?
Yeah.
But once you get over the barrier of doing some of the things that you're being asked to do.
But it's fun, like jumping.
And you start to go, and yelling, oh my God, I feel so free.
Yeah. Right.
And this is because I'm totally out of my comfort zone and now I'm okay with it.
That's right.
And there's something so powerful about being outside of your comfort zone
and the best
and
part
being
is
comfortable
the,
with it.
Yeah, the best part is the giant orgy at the end of every class.
Oh my God, dude, the orgy is really the just the cherry.
And you'd only really know this if you really knew Kundalini.
I'm in the wrong yoga school.
All of you people listening at home, you're just really missing out. Before we get too far into it, I just want to kind of like step in here. We don't usually have an intro. This is kind of how the podcast starts. But I think I think we should take a moment just to introduce you to the listeners and you know, I know we're going to get into quite of a story, but Beth Torbert,
That was my parents' name for me, but of course I am.
What do you go by now?
Well, because I got married.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Third time's a charm. I'm Alan. I have a habit of taking everybody's name, which is why I have such a great time at the border.
Beth Allen is nice, though.
I like it.
It rolls off the tongue.
Yeah, it's very nice.
It almost sounds like a hyphenated first name.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Beth Allen.
Oh, I like that.
It does, yeah.
I like that.
AKA Biff Naked.
That's me.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you sort of glossed over it, touched on it for a moment, but I guess we're here to talk about your experience with cancer.
Loved it.
Yeah, I bet.
No, I loved it.
Yeah,
it was fantastic.
I can't wait to get into that.
Oh, no, I loved it. It was like, it basically jerked off the geek in me every day.
Oh, yeah. Okay, okay.
Yeah,
well,
I'm fascinated by this.
Let's start with what kind of cancer did you have?
I call it tit cancer, but it was breast cancer.
Classic.
Yeah.
Classic.
And it was like, you know, for me, it wasn't, I was a vegan since 1996. I was orthorexic for a long time. Did yoga every day, probably worked out for 2 hours a day, did a 90-minute show every day.
What's orthorexic?
Where I over-exercise.
Addicted to exercise. Okay.
Okay. Right. Yeah, basically. And I think that it really gave me a sense of euphoria. I used to think it gave me a sense of control, but really exercise endorphins are amazing. They really do help you unless you have them flushing through you all the time. And then
they
can
be very addictive.
You can't figure out your cortisol and your dopamine, but that's another subject altogether. So I was really, really fit, really thin. I was a raw food vegan and a fruitarian at that point in my life.
What's a fruitarian?
So, and it was accidental. I didn't know I was a raw food vegan. I just didn't eat any cheese or milk or meat or anything like that. I didn't eat bread. And when we went on all these extensive tours in places like Europe or the southern United States, they gave the band beer and pizza.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was, you know, in my yogi brain, because at the time I was very stressed out and missed my dogs and, you know, always, I felt like I was always on the edge of not keeping my shit together. So I really went inward with reading and with, I guess, I don't know, spiritual textbooks. I loved theology. I'm just a geek for theology. Mm-hmm. And my dad was a dentist, but also he dropped out of medical school and gave me all his medical textbooks. So I drag all these things on the road and then, you know, I just would fast a lot if I couldn't have beer and pizza because I didn't drink. I didn't eat stuff like pizza. So I would fast and I would, you know, kind of enshroud it in my mind in this like, oh, it's, you know, I'm reaching a higher consciousness because I'm above this. It's okay.
Sure.
And it helped me kind of feel calm in a way in a stressful situation. And I always felt happy. But I was, as a result, really thin.
Was this? Do you think this was crossing over into like eating disorder territory?
Absolutely, okay. It was.
Okay.
And I get accused of it all the time because a lot of people who became introduced to raw food veganism, it became quite popular.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of girls, particularly, I don't know about guys, but girls get accused all the time, of doing it for dieting or this type of thing. And for me, it just really was an accident. I just wouldn't eat pizza or beer. I couldn't find any. There were no vegan restaurants when I was in my
20s. Yeah. And also, good luck finding a fucking apple in like Albuquerque.
Well, this is the thing. So, and I would eat a banana or I'd eat an apple. If I couldn't find anything, I'd get a red pepper from the grocery store and eat that before I went on stage, have an orange afterwards. And this kind of went on literally for a couple years. And someone went, "You're a raw food vegan." I was like, "Oh, okay, I guess I am. I just feel better because if I eat like this and then suddenly everyone goes for Chinese food in the band and I go, well, I'll just have a bowl of plain rice. You know, I won't shit for a week, you know, and I'll have a stomach ache because I'm not used to eating stuff like that. And a fruitarian was, again, accidental. Tomatoes, cucumbers, avocados are all fruits. So ultimately, they fall into that category.
How was your health throughout all of this?
I never got a cold. I never had allergies. Okay. I slept 4 hours a day because that was the job. It's still my job. When I'm touring, we don't tear down till 3 a.m. And if you get up at 5 regularly, you're going to sleep until 6. So you run on very little sleep. But I felt that I was, you know, I did fine. I never really thought about it. I just didn't get sick.
You said that though. You said you were like kind of on the borderline of like like stress and, and like almost probably anxiety to a certain extent.
Absolutely.
But then at the same time, you said you were really happy.
I felt that's also a compensation. It's in a way, it's a coping skill.
Okay.
And for me, as a optimistic person, you know, even if I was freaking out, I learned because of probably being a performer and never being by myself ever in a bus situation or anything like that. I just never was that girl who was, no matter what was going on, going to be mopey or going to be like, bring that energy onto my band because they were already like infants, like babies. That's okay.
How hard is it to be a touring musician? Like what?
It's easy.
It's easy. Like you don't find that the buses. I mean, I guess everybody has their own experience with it. Like some people are like, oh, the road destroys me. And
see, because Tay, you feel that way.
I know exactly.
And I'm the opposite of you.
Well, I don't feel that way about us because we do pretty short stints. I'm more so thinking of like you're on like how long would be
a big tour? So back in the day, it was buses. And you'd be out there for 10 weeks at a time, which is hard if you're with a bunch of guys who, you know, are drunk all the time or they sneak off to get cocaine or stuff like that.
Were you not a partier?
No, I became a straight edge when I was about 24 because that was basically the way I framed not drinking and smoking.
Do you have any straight edge tattoos? You're covered in tattoos, so I'm like, maybe there's just giant X on your back.
No, I X up my hands all the time.
And yeah, right.
At the time, and you know, now I don't identify as anything, even though I haven't changed any of my behaviors. I couldn't drink on tour because I would lose my voice.
Right, of course.
Yeah. I just talk too much and laughing, you know, I just, I couldn't do it.
Yeah, and as the front woman of a fucking rock band, your voice is so
pressure.
Key. Yeah.
I just couldn't do it.
Do you think that like the way that you lived your life actually increased the longevity of your career by not being like in encompassed in that kind of party lifestyle?
No.
You don't?
Not at all. I see too many people that I know who still tour, who still drink like fish, get paid in beer, the same things. And with us, like the touring thing, sometimes you get a bus. If you're in Europe, you need one because you don't know where you're going. but here, for example, I prefer to drive the van. And I always do the driving because I'm sober. So, I mean, it never gets old for me. I don't know when the hell it'll get old because it really should. But it never does. And I still like it. And I love it. I've been on tour since 1989.
I love that you love it because I romanticize the fuck out of that idea.
It's so fun.
A touring musician, that's one of my, like, you know, when I daydream of past lives. That was me one day, a touring musician.
It's fun to perform every day.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the bottom line. Nothing else really
nothing
comes close to it unless you have a podcast.
Yeah, well, that's what it is for me. Like,
sure.
You know, the creative expression has always been so important to me. And it used to be acting. Acting
your throat
was like,
chakra that must was my, be very active.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely, for sure. And so podcasting was the replacement for that for me. It was I've never felt more satiated than like last night when we sit in front of a crowd of, you know, 100 people and
it's a high.
Crack jokes about
for sure.
Shit. You know, like poop. You know, like that, like to me that's just
it's a high for sure. And I guess I guess we haven't really gotten like the taste of like the really constant, like one day we're here, the next day we're there, the day after that we're in a different place. Like I haven't really gotten that taste, so I don't know how I feel about it. But my the moments where you're on, where you're performing, right, are incredible. Yeah. Like it's, that's the, like, you're doing it all for that. Mm-hmm. And if the pleasure of that exceeds the like, oh, gotta get up at six, get on the, get in the car, pack the shit, do all the things, drive, eat probably not that great food because we're on the road.
Yeah.
And right, like if the pleasure of the stage and the high of the stage and the performance exceeds that, all the other stuff, then you're going to, you're getting a positive. You're coming, like, you're, cause yes, it's just, you're just weighing one against the other. And as long as the performance and the high from that is better, then you're going to be, you're going to, so obviously that's still how you feel.
It's the reward.
Yeah.
Every day is a reward. And, I mean, I don't know. It was, if I wouldn't have gotten diagnosed with breast cancer, I never would have stopped touring. And it forced me to stop in my tracks. At the time, I was doing a martial arts TV show. We were in between, like, European tours, American. I mean, it was just relentless.
So what was the moment when you realized that something was a little bit off?
I was scratching my armpit. This takes us back to me being completely underweight. And, you know, I had, I don't know, I might have had 8% body fat. So I didn't have, you know, I didn't have these, like, you know, great tits. I had nothing. And my skin was really thin. And it felt like there was a chickpea, a hard little chickpea, kind of like on the top of my chest almost. It wasn't even, it was upper left quadrant of the breast. And I was literally scratching my armpit and went, whoa, what is that?
Whoa.
And then kind of like palpitated this weird chickpea and I went, holy fuck, I have breast cancer. I knew
it. Oh, you knew it. You knew it.
Well, and I wasn't a hypochondriac or anything like that. And I don't think I was like, you know, some goddess intuition bullshit from the moon. Like, you know, no offense to anyone who actually has that.
Yeah.
But I just felt like, you know, for some reason, and I don't remember if it was in high school or when we were told that, but if you have a lump and it hurts, it's a cyst. Like, yeah, it doesn't hurt, it's bad. And always what we thought.
I never heard that before. Oh,
yeah. I don't know where I picked it up, but that was my thinking. And then I went to my GP the next day, and I was 36 at the time.
And at this point, how long have you been Biff Naked? How long have you been, like, touring musician?
Since I was 18.
18 to 36.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I never stopped.
And how old are you now?
I'm older.
Okay.
So that was over 10 years ago.
I'll fucking Google it.
It was 12 years ago.
Got it.
I'm going to be 50 in, like, you know, a couple of years.
That's super exciting.
Yeah, I love it.
Okay.
And so, and I never thought that I would live this long.
Yeah.
So, well, it's
why not,
like,
though? You never thought that you'd live this long, but have, like, so many healthy...
No punk rock chick I ever knew thought we would live past 30. I remember telling my poor mother that I was going to die of a gunshot wound.
Well, Courtney Love's still alive, so, I mean, somehow you guys fucking make it.
Exactly.
Yeah. There's that 27 club, man. Like, that's a dangerous age.
That's a weird thing, isn't it?
Once you get past it, though, I think you're going to go to the 99 club.
Exactly. And if you look at bands like Kiss, even Sylvester Stallone, is he in his 70s?
Who fucking knows? Sylvester Stallone in his 70s?
Yeah, and Creed is coming out next month, another Creed movie. Like, I mean, you know, now things have changed.
Yeah.
And things have changed a little bit, I think, for women.
Mm-hmm.
Previously, I never would have wanted to survive and live this long because I'd be like, are you kidding? I got to still tour. B, I got to, like, get old in front of people. What the hell? But now I look at, like, Tina Turner and I go, you know what? She's in a miniskirt. Because that's her deal. That's her shtick. And she still does it.
You know who else is 50? J-Lo.
Amazing.
J-Lo is 50. That's right. 50
Gwen Stefani.
Whoa.
Don't even talk to me about Gwen Stefani.
Stunning.
Right now. If I saw Gwen Stefani walking down the street, I would take this wedding ring and I would whip it at her face so hard and scream, please.
Yes. Yes.
I am so
So would I.
Is she 50?
Yeah.
But
69, baby.
Damn, dude.
You know what, though? I do want to say, like, through emailing and corresponding with you, like, leading up to this, I don't think I've ever, like, corresponded with, like, a more happy, optimistic, outgoing person that you can tell just through, like,
through
the way that you're writing.
Yeah.
But, like, and meeting you right now, like, I'm kind of surprised that, because, like, you just seem like such an eternal optimist that something like living forever would be like,
optimist.
Oh, like, even though everybody, I like to think that everybody knows that they're going to die someday.
Sure.
Like, it just, you just seem like the epitome of like happiness.
That's
and like
good.
Outgoing. Yeah, it's great.
I don't think it's
infectious.
Gloomy to think about or talk about death or to even envision it. Like
Amen.
When I was diagnosed, I went to the GP. He was like, don't worry about it. You're a vegan. Literally is what he told me.
Really?
Said, yes.
Interesting.
I said, I need a mammogram. He said, you're not old enough. It's not covered. So I can't refer you for a mammogram. I said, you have to.
Whoa,
I have cancer.
It's not covered by, even though he could probably just like feel that and go, that's.
He said it's probably nothing.
Oh, wow.
But I mean, that happens a lot. And it happens to a lot of people. And if I was a different kind of person, I might have gone, oh, thank God you said that. I feel so much better. And just gone home.
Yeah.
Right.
Which
but I knew I needed a mammogram. And again, it's not like I was like a hypochondriac. I just was like, yeah, I don't know. I just. No, this is weird. Like, it's new. I've never had it before. I think it's weird. And I didn't do self-exams. No chick I know. I still don't do them.
Yeah.
I mean, just like, do you do a ball exam? No, they feel weird.
I mean,
they're
I play with
weird.
My balls like,
which is different.
Like 75%
exactly.
of the day, but I'm not thinking about it, you know?
But I just thought, you know, that Ram Dass, for example, who is an amazing philosopher and writer, I remember, and I used to do my liner notes in all my CDs, and I used one of his quotes, which was, death is like taking off a tight shoe. And it resonated with me, and I think that I didn't realize how my life actually was, how stressed out I actually was. Mm-hmm. Because when the results came back from my biopsy, and they said, you have breast cancer, I was like, thank fucking God. Like, I am so tired. I'm exhausted. Now I can croak. Everyone is off the hook. Everyone can just like, you know, it's a noble death. You know, good looking corpse. You know, we're good. Right. I'm good. Yeah. I am happy to go out like that. You know, and I thought, that's great. And then I thought, oh, shit. Actually, no, I don't want my dogs to have to live without me. I want them to croak before me. And luckily that did happen. You know,
as so, dogs do.
As they often do.
Often do.
But it was, so it was amazing. It was a lot of epiphanies. And the first one was that I was actually thinking I could get off the hook.
So interesting.
Going through life.
That, you know what, there's something, so I cannot agree with you more about that. Loving that quote, death is like taking off a tight shoe. Like I've been, especially for the last like 3 years, we've been talking about death a lot, and I've been really preaching this idea of like, own your death, embrace your death, take it in, and love it, and find the joy that can really exist in
the
letting
meaning.
Go, in letting go of this very small momentary blip of time, because
right.
you know I don't know what comes next, and who gives a fuck what comes next, but if there is something that comes next, it's going to be beautiful. So it is very refreshing to hear someone come on and say something, and I don't think I've ever heard anyone come on the show and say that I got my diagnosis and was like you know,
absolutely.
Like
that was my first response.
To just sink into it and willingly with open arms, like that's fucking punk rock there.
I don't know if it's punk rock.
I think it's pretty badass.
It's never changed either, and I still think that
all
the time.
Mm-hmm.
No, it doesn't really change. I think that I survived for lots of different reasons, partly medicine.
Yeah.
But also, you know, being... It brought me into peer volunteering, and I never would have been off the road and in a hospital setting for enough time to discover that I really liked it, and I should have not been a rock person. I should have been a porter because I love the hospital. Mm. They should employ me. and I came into palliative care volunteering, and I discovered, wow, a lot of people really don't like doing this. I really like it. I don't know why, but I'm into it. And I think that this is kind of the direction that I need my life to go. And it was, man, it was just like epiphany after epiphany. And I don't think that it's the usual cheesy, oh, let's find the blessing in the disease or any of these things, because it is common.
Mm-hmm.
And that is partly a coping technique, but partly because it's true for people.
Yeah. It's true.
You know, when you're in a crisis, whether it's a health crisis or a family death or something that is a catalyst for change, you're going to discover all the strengths you have. You're going to discover the strengths and weaknesses in everyone around you.
I think that's so poignant because, like, so one of the questions that we usually ask our guests on the podcast is what is something that your illness has given you? And a lot of times it's like this renewed, like this new perspective on life,
or sure,
like this appreciation for many different things. But it's always seems like that is something that they discover in hindsight, mm, like looking back at it, or when they actually take the moment, like when right, we ask the question, then it's almost like they're having that thought now. Mm-hmm. But it seems like you had that like boom, like you're diagnosed and you're like, oh, amazing, this is so great because now I have this perspective. Like, yeah, yeah, it's pretty incredible that you...
Well, Beth Torberg like didn't get diagnosed also. Biff Naked got diagnosed. So that was a whole different thing too. And it became a weird thing, just like pregnant ladies, people touch them all the time. Mm-hmm. People will touch you if you're pregnant.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, people who don't know you. And if you're Biff Naked with breast cancer, it's different than being Beth Torberg with breast right, cancer.
So what do you mean by that?
Yeah. Like, well, because I was never allowed to be anonymous. I didn't have any privacy. And which was fine, but this was pre-Instagram. It was pre-Twitter. Mm. So it wasn't common for girls to like Instagram and Snapchat their wig fitting,
yeah,
you know, or whatever it was. And now it's just like, I mean, you know, now some of the old hags like us that, you know, made it, we make fun of the young ones, yeah, you know, and there's a real hierarchy. And I don't know if this happens in other areas, but there seems to be sometimes I've discovered with cancer patients and cancer care, there's a tier system among the patients who's more badass, who has a worse diagnosis, you know, and a lot of women are not, their symptoms are not taken seriously if they still have hair.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's where right, a lot of like sufferers wow, and yes, survivor's guilt comes from, you know?
Oh, it's
like,
sure.
Did yeah, you find that what year was that you had that single that just totally exploded? In like 2000-ish.
I'm still waiting for it. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're talking about I Love Myself?
I Love yeah, Myself Today, yeah, yeah.
Was that like 2000-ish? That was
probably. I think it was a little later than that. It was, probably became more well-known than, say, Spaceman, which yeah, was a younger audience.
Right. Yeah. And so, like, when... did that affect you negatively or positively? Being like it's kind of somewhere in the answer there that Biff Naked got the diagnosis,
that's
not
right,
Beth. Now, like, did that affect you negatively or positively on the diagnosis side, where you felt like this public persona of mine has cancer, and did it affect how you were able to deal with it?
All I knew how to do was perform. Mm. So then, being in the cancer ward, in a chemo ward or anything, the first thing I noticed was nobody talked. So you go into the room, if there are four other patients in there, nobody's talking.
Mm-hmm. So you just all just start a cappella, just so start singing like
suddenly,
Spaceman.
I'm out in my,
and they're like, what the fuck?
Or they ask me to sing.
Oh no, really?
Every time. So they either ask me to sing or I just naturally am gonna like pull out the top hat and cane.
Yeah, right.
You know, and because I'm an elevator talker.
Yeah.
Right.
So I try and diffuse it, and being a performer, I think no matter what happened, you know, I can pass out in a chair, or my surgical port will cause me to faint, or whatever the case. I'm still going to be singing Spaceman.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I'm
yeah,
not. I have to have a game face on. It was just really different. And at the time, I was not in a healthy relationship at home, so that individual's coping technique was not all that healthy, and I couldn't really do anything about that, or talk about it, or get any relief, or I don't know. It was it benefited me being a performer.
Well, right, that's the other thing I wonder about this, like this really like optimistic outlook that you have on your diagnosis. I'm curious how people in your life felt about your diagnosis, because you're obviously like, oh, this is great. Right. Now I can actually like.
Did you talk about it like that openly to the people in your life?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
all the
time.
And how did they respond?
I also have like four best friends that I've had since I was 18.
Okay.
So they know for sure. Mm-hmm. Like, and they will joke with me. We named my tumor. You know, they said, can I have your sneakers if you die? You know, because that's how our humor is, too.
What did you name the tumor?
JoJo. Mm-hmm. And I didn't name it. My best friend named it. And it was out. It was cut out pretty quickly. You know.
Did you call your scar Casey?
No. Do you have a scar named Casey?
You beat me to it.
Casey and JoJo.
Cool.
That's,
I see. Very cool.
We'll throw back to
some 90s. Yeah, no, it was. I didn't know. It was just like, yeah, my family was pretty cool about it. It wasn't until I started doing palliative care volunteering that I experienced witnessing family members and friends of patients that would basically throw themselves on the hospital bed of the person who's like trying to watch the sports channel and just basically like they're at the wailing wall, wailing on this person. And me going, you need a fucking bouncer in here. Yeah. This is bullshit. Yeah.
Like I know a few.
Really? Yeah. Yeah. And so it's like, it was interesting to learn how other people's families and the other dynamics for other people was. And it was generally really unhealthy.
It was very common. We had
very interesting.
We were just at breakfast and we were talking about how oftentimes when someone dies or when someone gets a diagnosis of something, it's oftentimes the system, the support system around the person that's sick that actually needs the most support.
Yes.
And it often ends up on the shoulders of the person that's sick to give the support, to reassure, okay, it's fine. I'm accepting of it. I'm taking the steps that need to be done to get healthy or whatever.
Absolutely.
And it seems unfair but it also is kind of this
natural.
It's this natural way. It's like people just, there's something about the human condition that makes us think, oh, this is affecting me in this way, and how do I protect myself against this? Like, Biff's sick, and that makes me feel this way, and I don't like it, and I need this, and I need that. It's just this kind of natural, again, narcissism might be too strong of a word, but there's some narcissistic characteristics in how people take news and how they need to be comforted, and we all have it, you know. Mm-hmm. Like when someone dies, it's the grief. It's how you feel when someone gets sick. How you feel about that person's
Absolutely.
Diagnosis. Did you feel like you needed to be the support system for anybody around you?
Oh, sure. And I do think I agree with you. I think it's natural for people. Mm-hmm. People are they unconsciously do that, and it's not that they're not, you know, awakened individual or evolved enough to not make it about themselves. It actually is not even. I don't even know if it's narcissistic because they are just unaware. They're not in touch with themselves to even recognize that that's what they're doing to a patient. But when a patient is living, not yet dead, and having to, it would be natural for that person to console. So they're consoling their parents because they're sick, and they're consoling their spouse, their children. You know, it's very exhausting, but ultimately, you know, suddenly it's almost weird. You can look at it in a bit of a spiritual way. You know, I'm always going to find a silver lining to everything, whether it's a childlike optimism or whether it is, I'm going to find a spiritual meaning behind it. And I sometimes think that the patient almost becomes resilient to having any sense of resentment for those people who are unconsciously trying to burden them with their own shit.
Did Ram Dass or yoga and all this stuff, did that all come before you got sick?
Absolutely.
Was that stuff that you were already into?
So there was something called the Krishna punks that was happening. All our heroes were into it. So Cro-Mags, John Joseph, who's a huge hero of mine and has been since I don't know, like the 80s, they became really interested in Hare Krishna. And when we were in the early 90s and stuff and all our friends started shooting heroin on the West Coast, you know, we would go kind of start reading about Krishna consciousness to try and basically avoid shooting smack.
Yeah.
And just in my own discovery, you know, the Tao, Buddhism, Krishna, like all theology, all religion leads to the same place, ultimately.
Yeah.
You know, people get pissed when I say that, especially, you know, really fanatical people. Yeah. They're like, oh, you're...
The world would be a much better place.
You're speaking the devil, bitch.
If we could all understand that.
Great.
All leads,
I love them. I love him too.
many ways to the top of the mountain, you know?
But it's, you know, and I think it is... I think that probably also is something that, for me, probably benefited me. And a lot of people who I've met in cancer care in North America, mostly the white people I've met are all Christians. And the people who are more faith-based in their life tend to not necessarily survive longer, but they survive all the shit.
Yeah.
Emotionally a little bit better, because really and truly faith does get people through, and that's what gets people through, whether it's, you know, yoga consciousness, whether it is the Buddha, Jesus, Muhammad, doesn't matter. Faith really does help people get through. And if it's just, you know, faith in the medical system, mm-hmm. or faith that your spouse is going to be really wonderful, you know, with your surviving kids or dogs, or, you know, your faith will always get you through.
We had this really amazing guy on our podcast, a chaplain named David McGinley. It was our 100th episode, and he mm-hmm. was what religion was he associated with?
Episcopalian, maybe. Maybe it was what's the one that starts with the P?
Protestant or something like that.
Pescatarian.
Yeah, pescatarian.
That's bitch.
So, but he was
Presbyterian.
It might have been Presbyterian.
Yeah, but he had a religious affiliation, his message was like, he was almost like, I might get a bit of hate from the people in my religion, but I really am trying to preach this ultimate belief in this higher power, so that there's some type of consolation and like to the entire process of dying, and mm-hmm. it makes it easier also for the family to go through the grieving process as well. And he was like, look, I don't care what you believe in necessarily, just that you have a belief in something.
Yeah. Sure.
He's a fascinating, he's a guy functioning on another.
Wow.
He very much
he is. He's one of those like special people where when you have a conversation with him, you're like,
you're better for having met him.
Oh yeah, you're on another
Isn't
level.
That amazing?
Well, he's very very akin to like reading Ram Dass. When you read Ram Dass and you just feel like every sentence is changing your soul. Like there's so much perspective in his words.
You know what though? Also, I think a lot of that wisdom comes from, you know, he does have that whole background of his religion and his teachings and his upbringing. But he also, I think, took a lot of that wisdom from when he died.
Right. Yes. That's right.
He actually lost his life, flatlined, and was revived, and had a, you know, which a lot of people mm-hmm. have this experience of like the near death experience.
Yes.
Well, he had an experience, and it was very tangible for him, and he worked that into what he was already sort of working with in his life and his beliefs. And I think it's mm-hmm. it definitely aided him in becoming more, I don't know, like powerful with his message.
And Ram Dass was at the heart of, I can't remember his name, what his like given name was. No, I can't remember it, but he was at the heart of like the Harvard studies for LSD.
Yeah.
And then when it came down, was like, you know, you can't, that LSD became illegal or whatever they did legally for LSD. They stopped the trials and then he started carrying out these not approved
LSD.
LSD studies. Yeah. And, but it led him into this world of like spirituality. And, mm-hmm. and I'm sure that he would look to LSD and go, yeah, my experiences with LSD have influenced like all these, like this, the years and years of practice and philosophy that I've had. And I mean, I would recommend him to like anybody who's going through life in general, but especially really tough shit like dying or or grief for people that are leaving or illness or whatever, because there's just so much perspective in his words.
Sick Boy Podcast will be right back after this word from our sponsors.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
I want to take it back to your particular experience with cancer and breast cancer, tick cancer. Yeah. Your tick cancer.
It's funny.
Yeah, it is.
We're gonna call it the word tit.
It's,
this episode is going to be called Tit.
Biff's tit cancer.
The year of the tit.
Yeah. And there's something very different between tit and tits. Tit is like singular.
Yeah.
As a it comes off very well.
Denunciate.
So when you were going through it, the treatment phase of things, how challenging was that for you to like go from the lifestyle you were living and then right into fighting this cancer with however you fought it?
It was annoying.
Yeah.
In a way, because the first it was a bit of a hand-wringing experience deciding to do chemo. My parents really wanted me to live. So they're both academics, and they were like, why is this a question? I'm like, because of animals and, you know, or whatever my things were. And
well, what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I know a lot of vegans, for example, especially now in the world where there's a lot of vegan police. You know, it's a thing. Don't get mad. People get admonished for doing chemotherapy because of medical animal testing.
Whoa. Yeah.
And in Canada, it is the law to test medicines on animals.
Yeah,
so we're working against animal testing for cosmetics in Canada. We're trying to get that banned. And that's something that I am, you know, trying to get behind and encourage other people to get behind. But as far as medicine goes, you know, we're not really allowed to even touch it because it is the law.
Mm-hmm.
I can offer and sign up for clinical trials. You guys can sign up for clinical trials. We can do our best to say, well, just test on me instead. But for the rest of the world, it's illegal.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, you know, my argument, and I had to argue my case with a lot of vegans who are like, you know, you're such a hypocrite doing chemo. And I'm like, okay, you go die.
Yeah, God, that sounds super extreme.
I was also accused of not being a vegan.
I mean, that sounds like Bob Marley being like, well, you know what? Whatever, dead. You know, like, it just sounds like, you know, what a waste. Like, you could have been saved, but that sounds, my girlfriend's vegan. She's been vegan for the better part of 2 decades. And that is just, I've never heard of that. I didn't know that.
Oh, it's amazing. And, you know, I am very, very lucky because I basically fly under the radar. I'm non-confrontational. I do try to be optimistic. I don't, you know, engage with people who are that type of way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But, for example, I think it was Miley Cyrus or I forget who it was, but people very, very frequently say, I hope you get cancer to her on social media. I hope your family dies of cancer. Go die. Like, all, it's amazing the world we live in.
Right,
and
yeah.
So back, you know, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, when I was debating, you know, and the fact that I had a debate is actually, you know, really nuts, but debating what treatments to do, I had to literally weigh that in my mind.
So you were thinking like, I wonder if I won't do this because
even
of
that, because there are a lot of people who aren't sick, who say, oh, you should just only do cannabis oil, or oh, you can do this with Gerson, or you can go to Mexico. And as a volunteer, I still hear that to this day. A lot of people, well, no, my mom doesn't want to go the chemo route. She wants to do it naturally. And I have to keep a neutral face and say, okay, well, how can I support you? Mm-hmm. And that's my job. How can I support you? I can't say,
Not to argue.
Yeah, you know, and I can't sit there and tell them, well, I knew 3 other girls who died from, you know, I can't.
Yeah.
So for me, I chose to do chemotherapy, and because I had a pre-existing heart condition, which we'll still get to because it gets worse, where I was born with a PFO, it was a hole in the heart wall.
Okay.
I wasn't eligible for some of the chemotherapy stuff that my colleagues or fellow patients were on. So I had to do 6 rounds of something, this one drug. And then I had to do, because my breast cancer was estrogen receptor positive, meaning being a chick, you know, made it worse.
Mm-hmm.
Being chick, having chick hormones, you know, made it worse. You know, you don't want to get aroused or anything. If your estrogen flows, you're like, ah, don't arouse me. My tumor will grow.
It just feeds the tumor, estrogen?
Estrogen. So it grew from estrogen. And so they had to keep me on something called a biological for 11 months, which is why I got the surgical port. Surgical port was a problem because I have a procoagulant blood disorder. That means I make clots. I love them. I love sticky blood. I love making clots. I love throwing them. And I got a clot in the port and had to have it taken out. But I loved my port. You know, I loved it all. I was skinny enough that it looked like a bottle cap under my collarbone. It was like really, I looked like I was in the Borg.
I'm scared of ports. I haven't had one yet. And the day will come. But
it was easy. I loved it. But I'm also, you know, for me, you know, just like getting tattooed or anything that hurts, molar removal, I don't take any drugs for that. I don't like getting frozen.
That's gnarly.
Right?
Because so awake.
The reaction you guys have makes it worth it for me. That's all there is. That's right there. No shit. That's why.
I was with you on the tattoo thing, and then you said molar removal. Yeah. I was like, fuck that.
Yeah, that's
a different,
that's a different level. Yeah.
That's
so you're a masochist? Yeah.
No, I just, you know, it was just part of my attitude where I didn't want to take painkillers or anything like that because I wanted to know how long it was hurting. Wow. You know, I don't want to cover up a headache.
Yeah.
You know, I want to know if I can just like have water or.
Is this part of that straight edge thing? Or
probably part of that.
A little bit, yeah.
So, the surgical port thing was like a cool factor for me. It was like about being tough and it made me feel empowered.
Mm-hmm. I think it's part of like the optimism of you though too, and like that always trying to find the positive, because in a way it almost sounds like, you know, like that dealing with a molar removal, for example, without any meds, it's like feeling this intense feeling makes me feel alive. Like
plus it's interesting.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it is.
Plus
yeah.
It's very interesting. I mean, Novocaine, if I didn't know what Novocaine felt like, I wouldn't be able to speak to it. Years later, I'm going to fast forward, after my tit cancer, I had a kidney infarct, which was a stroke in my kidney. And that was because...
A stroke in your kidney?
I had a hole in my heart, and the blood clot that I had went the wrong way and went into my kidney instead of my brain or my heart.
That sounds like overall good news.
Technically, it was good news. But when I went into emergency, I was like, I can't stand up. I don't know what's wrong. Oh. They did an ultrasound. They're like, oh, your cancer's back.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we're going to remove your kidney, the tumor's in your kidney because it's all black and dead. I was like, thank God it's over. It's finally over. Yeah. Oh, my God. I was in divorce at the time. Anyway, so they discovered
that. For context.
Yeah, it was like, so it was really interesting. They didn't have to remove my kidney. They did discover it was a blood clot. And then this guy who looks like Superman, who was a cardiologist, came into my hospital room and said, I wake up every day and I think to myself, I'm going to fill holes today. And I looked at him and went, holy fuck.
You're like
Clark Kent.
I want you to fill you mine. That's right. It was beyond. It was like beyond. It was like God said, here's this pie. What do you do with this pie?
Eat it.
So in the operating room with this dude and his nurses, because they don't crack your chest open anymore.
For a kidney. They just
for my heart.
Oh, for your heart. Oh, okay, yeah,
they
right.
They didn't crack my chest open. They just make an incision in your leg and thread the camera up with a little umbrella
in your leg
that they're gonna make close the hole in your heart. And so to make that incision in my leg, they have to inject Novocaine into my groin. Now, if you recall the dentist, the molecular weight of Novocaine, cane being the important part, mm-hmm. as in cocaine, mm-hmm. Novocaine. It's very heavy. And when we get that injection, it aches. In our jaw, it just aches. There's something that aches about it. It's because of the molecular weight. So when they inject Novocaine into my groin so that they could make this incision and thread the camera up that big artery into your heart, it felt like the same thing. The same thing. And so I, because I'm awake, go, ugh. It feels like the dentist between my legs. And these nurses who couldn't contain themselves giggling to death because of what I said. Meanwhile, I'm on whatever, you know, sedative. I'm on Demerol, which is truth serum or whatever it was. And I thought,
doctor, fill my holes.
Seriously.
Just like the dentist.
And it was amazing. And I thought that right there is I could die happy. I could die happy right now. No one, those two nurses were giggling. And it was amazing. And having heart surgery really feeling the umbrella close and feeling literally me have to take a breath because I'm Twilight, but literally not knowing what they're doing. I'm not watching it. And I went and took the deepest breath I've ever taken in my life. And I went, holy fuck. And in my brain, I was like, oh my God, my heartbeat's been rewritten right this moment.
Wow. My heart.
And it was the most coolest thing I've ever experienced in my life. And I just thought, this is fucking excellent.
So that was when
I'm
going to
clean my car.
Yeah.
God, I'm going to clean my car. If I live through this, I am cleaning. It was just like amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was like when they when they like closed up the hole.
That's right.
You were like...
Literally.
Like when like Uma Thurman getting like jammed into the heart with the...
But it was so cool. And I just thought, you know, that is the coolest thing I've ever experienced so far.
Yeah.
Out of anything, breast cancer was nothing compared to that.
Yeah.
And I just think, breast cancer, that's not organ pain. You know, organ pain is very, very different from, you know, tit pain.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, you can cut a tit off.
Yeah.
You know, did you have to have a mastectomy?
Is that, had what's considered a partial mastectomy. I think, and of course, like most patients, I said, cut them off. Doc, just cut everything off. I don't need them. I'm skinny. It's really punk rock for me to have these big scars. It's great. Love it. Just cut them off.
It's going to be great. Yeah, great for my image. Great for the publicist. Yeah.
It would have been.
Yeah, totally.
You know, how cool would that be?
Yeah.
Put a big tattoo, an X across my chest.
Doing shows
but
topless.
They, you know, ultimately, they were like, well, we have the same outcomes with chemotherapy and radiation versus doing the mastectomy. Mm-hmm. And I mean, years later, when I volunteer with enough girls who are rookie patients who are faced with the same things, you know, there's the skeptical people who go, well, it's cheaper for them not to do that double surgery. It's cheaper for them just to throw you in the system. But I don't like to believe that. I like to believe that that was the correct thing for me to do. And, I mean, I can't really say. They took my ovaries out to make sure that there's no estrogen being made to grow it back.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Is that common?
I think so.
For breast cancer,
you know,
patients?
And I meet people who say, "Oh, they didn't take your uterus. Oh, well, you're going to get uterine cancer now from the cancer drugs that you took for breast cancer." And I just go, "Mazel tov! Like that's great.
Yeah, thank you.
Like, good. Jesus.
Thank you for the information.
What do you say to that?
Thanks, Pessy.
Yeah,
like you're really.
But it's cool, you know. And I think that I don't know. I'm glad that I went through it all because I like being able to know about it firsthand, so that when I am working with a new patient, I can say, this is what I did, or I totally relate to that. This is what happened for me. And now it's so different. If I was diagnosed today, I believe that my treatment protocol would have been very, very different.
Mm-hmm. In what way?
Now, a lot of girls that I meet who are stage two, like I was, but if they have no lymph node involvement, for example, some of them don't get chemo. They only get radiation, you know, or they get tamoxifen or Arimidex for 8 years instead of five and nothing, you know? So there's lots of different things. I lost all my fingernails and my hair from my chemotherapy, but now...
Fingernails? I didn't know that was a
thing.
They
all went black, but my toes were fine. And some other chemotherapy protocols, people lose all their nails.
Wow.
But now they have these gloves that ladies wear during the infusion. No other time will it be effective. But during the infusion, they can put on these ice gloves, literally ice gloves,
it's just like
that will keep their nails
freeze
on.
Freeze your nails into place.
It's the weirdest thing.
Whoa,
and I know
so
another girl who is triple negative, and she wears an ice cap on her head to keep her hair in.
Whoa.
Does that work?
Apparently.
Cool.
So just
and
the
they
cooling
hadn't
effect
developed
of it?
That. I'm not really sure. And again, you know, some of these protocols are only during infusion. If they try it some other time, it doesn't work. But for whatever reason, during the infusion is when it's most important to do that. It's just like, and that all came from a clinical trial, which is, you know, to me, just amazing.
The coolest. Yeah,
you know, I probably missed it by a month or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Do you still perform? Do you still?
So I wrote a book that came out in 2016. with HarperCollins, and that was a really interesting experience. And again, my manager badgered me into writing this memoir. He's like, well, you haven't croaked, so, you know, you should write about
it. Get to work.
Yeah, and it's just kind of funny. And we were able to kind of fold doing a book tour into an acoustic show. And we came to Halifax. We did two shows at the Carlton in Halifax, which was great. And basically, I read stories from the book, and then we'll play an acoustic song to go with the story.
Now, the acoustic songs, were you writing them or were you doing like renditions of older stuff?
Correct. Mostly. There were two or three new ones, but mostly it was.
Okay.
Yeah.
A question that I have for you is that, you know, as an artist, particularly a musician, how much did what you've gone through like affect your writing and sort of find its way into your art? I wonder this because are you familiar with Wintersleep?
That's a band, right?
Yeah. Yes. They're a band like based out of Atlantic Canada, based out of Halifax, and they've done really well. And when I was in high school, late high school, and first like years of university, they were my favorite thing in the world. Mm. And their music was so sad and so like just like gut wrenching and like heavy. And then I think they all got like married and had kids and got really fucking happy. And then like their later albums, I was like, fuck these guys. Like, this is no longer any good. Yeah. They're too happy. Yeah. So sorry, Wintersleep. If you guys are listening, which one of you might be, I'm really sorry, but your earlier stuff was better. So I'm wondering if this obviously big shift in your own life played a role in actually like changing the way that you wrote your art and your songs.
Oh, definitely. When I was still in chemo, I made a record called The Promise because I still had to work. Like every other patient that I knew, I still had to work full time. So in the studio, we did a record called The Promise, and one of the songs on there, which was the first single, was called Sick. And it was about having chemo. Mm. And I found that record is very, very different from a lot of my other records in a lot of ways. The singles that we've made after that, I made a dance record after that we never released called The Jakarta Project. And I had a single called So Happy I Could Die, which is very directly related to how I live life, but it was kind of right after my heart surgery. And I don't know. With the new stuff, we've been writing a record for the last couple years. And the problem with releasing records now is it's just the motivation is so different because the way people experience and get their music is different.
Yeah.
There's no revenue in it.
The industry is completely shifted.
I can't sell a CD at a show. I give them away. Or unless I call it a car CD.
Yeah.
And then I can sell for $5. Yeah, sure. But ultimately, so things have changed a lot. But we still we're doing a rock tour that leaves this this month, and we tour every summer, and we still do lots of shows. I find that now I've finally gotten comfortable with doing rock shows again. Whereas for a long time, I really only felt comfortable doing acoustic shows. Mm. It just felt. To me, it felt unnatural to go back to the mosh pit and stage diving. I felt like, I don't know. It seems like it's contrived. That's not the place I'm in. I don't feel like that. Mm. But in the last year, and particularly since I've started playing music with my husband specifically, now it's back to motorcycle boots and getting in fights. We love it. It's so much fun.
It's because it feels real.
Yeah. And for a long time, I was comfortable just doing the acoustic stuff. And it actually worked out great because the book came out and we did two national tours that were the book tour. So it was the correct time.
What was the book called?
Ibificus.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah.
Is there a time and place still now for the acoustic stuff as well?
I did one in Toronto in July at the Harbourfront Centre, and that was part of their series they were doing called Brave, and that's always fun. And my husband Snake gets really drunk on French wine while I talk, and then I go, "Are we ready to play a song?" And then he just kind of goes, "Okay." And then we play a song, and then I talk for another. That's fun. Awesome.
Out of your work through the palliative care world, are you familiar with Stephen Jenkinson?
I know that name.
Yeah, he's written a couple books. One's called Die Wise.
Oh, is this the guy that you were telling me about the other day?
Yeah, I saw him the other day at the International Death Symposium. I was speaking there.
And
he was also a speaker there.
Very interesting. Is he from here?
He's from Northern Ontario.
I see.
And he teaches up there. He teaches a lot. He's worked in palliative care for ages.
Timmins or where in North
it's Ontario? You know what? I've never heard of the place.
Oh.
It's like he's a farmer, lives on some farm.
Interesting.
But he does this live show that I saw the other night, and it was one of the most profound and cathartic performances I think I've ever witnessed in my life. And he basically it's similar to what you were talking about, is he's up there, he's got a backing band, but it's very like slow, moody, kind of bluesy stuff. And he reads passages from his book or just writing it from his journal.
Yeah.
And it's all around death and dying.
Interesting.
And he's really, really fantastic. But
wow.
I'll look him up because I feel like he would be right up your alley.
Well, there's a course here that they have that I've been interested in for a couple years. And so, and you're probably familiar with it, but I wasn't until I moved here. And it's a course for death doula.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And so that's something that I can see. Mm-hmm. It would be such an important part, just like people who like to use birth doulas mm-hmm. in their birth journey. Mm-hmm. To me, it makes so much sense that there would be someone like that in the room for a family and for a patient.
It's a beautiful concept.
Yes, it is.
Someone to just support you.
There's a great course here.
Yeah. It's like, you know, mm-hmm. you've got a buddy that's there just for that transition, that process.
That's right.
And not just a buddy for you, but for everybody else who's going to be in that room and involved with what that's going to look like.
Yeah.
I think it's fucking beautiful.
Yeah. I remember somebody, I can't remember who it was now. I think it was Ben Nempton that was like when we were talking about all these things in life. Like if you are a basketball player, you're a hockey player, whatever, you're anything in the sports world, it's like you're expected to have a coach. Mm-hmm. And you're expected to have a coach because you know that you don't know have all the answers and that somebody has been there before or at least studied to a certain degree that can lead you and give you knowledge on how to be better in whatever that area is. And in the conversation we were having with Ben was around therapy and that, you know, a therapist is a life coach. And they give you insights on how to weigh decisions and make all these things about life. And this death thing is all the same. Like we can't expect to be experts in all these areas. Like we just intuitively know what to do. Mm. Some people do, for sure. But the average person probably doesn't know how to go through grief, you know, like or to prepare for a loss or for somebody who's dying to die. Like that's a really tough process. Mm-hmm. And to have that companion or person that has studied in this field to kind of be with you on that journey it just seems so common sense when you relate it to things like sports, where it's like, of course you have a coach. Of course you do.
Yeah.
But even the most brilliant people on this planet have teachers.
Of course. That's right. Yeah. Of course.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But there's all these things in life that we just go, well, you should just know how to do that.
That's right.
Do you think, what's your involvement currently right now in volunteer work and palliative care and that kind of world?
I'm waiting to do an orientation.
Okay.
Most of the hospitals, they want you to do their orientation before they give you access to a ward. How I came into it was kind of unorthodox because, again, you know, with social media, people can contact me and with patients and with regular folks who don't have a podcast or who don't work in the entertainment industry. They contact me on Facebook more than any other place.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not on Facebook. I used to be able to just post my Twitter post on there, and now that stopped for some reason. I don't know why that's not, they don't do that anymore, but now I have to actually log in. But they would contact me and say, my daughter is, you know, on the 10th floor at Vancouver General, and she's in palliative care. She's a big fan. It would mean a lot to the family if you came by. And I remember the first time I ever saw that and me thinking, oh my fucking God, I don't know the first thing. What do I do? But I knew for sure there's not a possibility in me. It's not how I'm built. I can't say no. Mm-hmm. How can you say no to that? You cannot.
Yeah.
So I went and it was, I became invested in the family, and I went again the next day, and then that's kind of how it started. And then someone else in the ward asked me to come and see their family member, and that's just how it started, really organically. And from time to time, I still get those unorthodox requests mm-hmm. where I don't go through hospital administration.
Right.
And I just am a repeat visitor.
That's really incredible.
I can't not think about, like, how fucking trippy it would be right. if someone was on their deathbed. You, right. you become a death doula. Someone's right. on their deathbed.
Right.
And they are like, you know, they are the biggest Biff Naked fan. They always have been. They didn't even know. They didn't listen to this podcast. They didn't know you're into the death doula thing. Right. And then they're like, your death doula's here. And in walks Biff Naked. And they're like, I'm hallucinating. I think it's happening now.
Oh, fuck.
You know, like, yeah, what a trip that would be.
I guess so, but it's just, yeah, you know, ultimately, if, you know, if I wear a sweater, a lot of people don't ever think it's me.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, sure. Not really.
Sure. The tattoos are a big, like, kind of giveaway, right?
Mostly, yeah. That's what it is.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah.
This has been such a, like, treat. This conversation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And
for me.
I honestly want to thank you so much for.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad we got in touch.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Definitely. And I before we wrap it up, there's a question that we often ask our guests at near the end of the episode. And I would be kicking myself if we didn't ask you this. It's a two-parter. First one is, what would you say your experience in, I mean, I want to just say with your with breast cancer, but I think, like, out of everything we've talked about today, your experience in all of that, what would you say is the biggest thing that it's taken away from you?
I think that it took away, for me, it took away any inflexibility that I had left. If I was ever inflexible about anything in life, you know, people get thrown a curveball, scheduling changes, anything like that. You know, people tend to, you know, go bananas over it. It took away any last morsel of being inflexible that I had. And I think that it takes something like that to bring us into ourselves. And also, for me, having breast cancer also coincided with me turning 40. So I couldn't differentiate. What some of the benefits were, if they just really came with age and experience, or if they came with being in the healthcare system, or if it came with being in a room full of like-minded people. Mm-hmm. It all happened at the same time. And to be able to kind of, literally cancer, you know, heart surgery, stroke, anything that happened to me that was unexpected in my health or that threatened my life longevity forced me to roll my shoulders down my back, really and truly, and just relax. It forced me to go, okay, and start. I just became calm. And that was something that I can't attribute to a coping technique like optimism or you know, jazz hands is what I called that attitude of coping. It just forced me to stop being inflexible. And that's been really a great thing.
Okay, so the second part is, what's the biggest thing that it's given you? And did you already just answer it? Did you take that optimistic?
Yes and no, because I try and think of what it gave me that I didn't have before. Because I was always into learning about gurus. I was always into yoga. I was always into healthy eating. So, you know, I had to search it. I really struggled to figure out, you know, what did I learn without, you know, thinking to myself, oh, I fucking knew it all. You know, it wasn't like that. But what did I learn that was new? What happened that was new? And I think that what it really did was turn me into a woman. And prior to that, I think that I hadn't really, I can't describe it because I don't want to minimize it in a hippie way and go, well, I found my fucking moon goddess or whatever bullshit that was. But it threw me into menopause at 36 years old by taking out my ovaries. Mm. And suddenly I realized, oh, hey, dude, like, our grandmothers were all like whining cunty, like full of shit people because there's nothing wrong with this shit. We don't bleed anymore. Literally, like, why is that bad? Like, and I suddenly was like, this is the biggest, greatest gift that ever happened was not bleeding and being a woman, like embracing being a woman. Stop being orthorexic. Stop being like wanting to look like a boy with tits and stop. I really started to embrace myself. And again, I don't know if it was turning 40, you know, and that kind of relaxing into yourself that comes with age that I think happens to all people. I used to say all men and women, but now I have to say everybody. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I do think it comes with age and experience that we start to chill out a little bit. And I really, really embraced it. I highly recommend menopause for any woman who's listening. I recommend it. It's like having a tropical vacation 2 or 3 times a day. There's no more blood, you know. You don't have to worry about that. I don't know.
That's fucking amazing.
Yeah,
it's funny, the truth. Yeah. And you know, when you learn to look at things with that type of humor and you know, silliness, and almost like your 10-year-old Kundalini brain turns on about life. You can handle anything, and anything that you're going to go through is actually, there's going to be not just epiphany in it, you're going to find a pleasure in it. Mm.
This is one of those moments where I feel so overwhelmed with gratitude.
Are you guys going to make me cry? I am a menopausal.
You're making me cry.
Yeah, I'm a menopausal woman.
I mean it. Like, this is one of those moments where I feel so overwhelmingly grateful to have this with the two of you, that we're able to have conversations like this. This is a conversation that I'll never forget, and
nor will I.
I had no idea what to expect before you coming in here, and I'm just like, and it's not about us, because I know that even just those two answers you just gave, there's going to be so many people that hear that, and it's going to touch them so fucking deeply.
Yeah.
And I'm so grateful for that. And I'm so grateful for you.
Like kittens.
Yeah.
Everybody with a kitten heart. It's so good. Yeah.
So thank you. Thank you for taking your time to come in today.
No, it's been a real privilege for me.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Thank you so much. Before we
wrap things up the way we do, what current projects do you have on the go right now? And what do you want to shout out to the people who are listening?
Yeah, shameless plug.
Yeah.
Oh, well, we're making a documentary called Ibificus right now.
Nice.
And it wasn't my idea, and it is just really, really all consuming, and it's amazing. I'm doing another book right now, which is basically the ABCs of how to be a Zen riot girl. And I don't know. We're doing a new record. It's going to be out in 2019, and it's extremely loud and boisterous, and which is very enjoyable for me.
Sweet.
Hopefully life continues to be challenging, frustrating, and joyful, which is how it should be. It should be full and just nuts every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Sweet. Well, thanks. Yeah. Everyone keep an eye out for that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Well, again, Beth, thank you.
Thank you guys for having me.
And thank you all so much for tuning in. We'll be back next week, as we always are. And in the meantime, head on over to Apple Podcasts, rate, review, subscribe. It's one of those things that just keeps us on the iTunes charts, and it means the world to us so that people can hear amazing conversations just like this one that you just heard. Mm-hmm. And if you want to support us so we can continue to make these trips to talk to amazing people,
you can go to patreon.com/sickboy. Big part of how we're able to be in this room with Biff right now. So thank you to everybody who's helped us in that. And if you'd like to support us, patreon.com/sickboy.
And a big shout out to Donovan, the Meerkat Morgan, for the sound design on the show. You are greatly appreciated. And thanks to Take Part for our regular theme music. And that's all I got.
That is it for this week.
I'm Brian.
I'm Taylor.
I'm Jeremy.
And I am Biff.
And this is Sick Boy.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.